It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about NASA's Artemis 1 mission to the moon. Now, have you ever wanted to drop everything, hop in a car, a plane, a boat, and just go? That's, in effect, what our next guest did with a little more planning in a single-engine trawler boat. Their journey took over a year and was more than 6,000 miles long. It's called America's Great Loop, a giant loop including rivers, waterways, and some open ocean that takes you around the eastern chunk of the United States. Jill and James Iverson started that journey where they live in Manitowoc and ended the trip there in September. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
And James, thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
And James, can you briefly tell us what America's Great Loop is?
Well, you kind of described it well in your introduction. It's a circumnavigation of the eastern third of the United States and part of Canada. And it's about 6,000 miles long. It includes going through about 106 locks. And there's voyages on the Great Lakes, on the rivers, on the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow. And Jill, I imagine you don't just hop in your boat and do this. What kind of planning and preparation went into this trip?
Well, we did do some planning. We're longtime cruisers, I should tell you that. So maybe we didn't have to do quite as much planning as people that are brand new to boating. And there are people that do the loop with very little experience, but we've been boating for decades. So, but to get ready for this trip, we did some planning, but not too much because we really like to be spontaneous and make plans along the way as we go.
I want to ask each of you a favorite part of the trip, and I know it'll be hard to pick just one, but what's something that stood out in your mind? Jill, let's start with you.
Okay. Although I loved big, you know, New York City and being alongside the Statue of Liberty, I have to say, St. John's River was really, really special. It's old Florida, old world Florida. So we took a 150-mile side trip off the loop from Jacksonville, Florida, and went all the way down the state, down the middle of the state. And we were especially excited to anchor out behind Pontoon State Park on the Dead River. It was like a jungle. We were surrounded at night using our beam. We saw alligator eyes and we heard limpkins, which are birds that scream and sound like someone being murdered. People actually call 911 when they
wow.
hear these birds and wood storks who are huge storks that can clack through bones. So we felt like we were in Jurassic Park. It was wonderful. We stayed an extra 2 days.
Wow. And James, did you have another favorite part?
Yeah, I have to say, as much as I love the St. John's River, one of the highlights for me was anchoring out right next to the Statue of Liberty and spending the night there and watching the lights of the city wink on at night and just being surrounded by it all. And the statue itself is such an iconic thing. We've all seen photographs of it, but to be anchored right next to it was quite a thrill for me.
And Jill, I might think, you know, you're in a boat, just the two of you. It might be kind of like isolating, but reading up on what you did, it sounds like there's a really strong feeling of community and you met a lot of interesting people along the way.
Oh, we really did. First of all, especially on the rivers, you really build relationship with the other loopers because you all have to go through the locks. And by the way, we went through 106 locks on these trips. So you all have to go through the locks and you all have to tie up to a wall or a marina or anchor. So we kept running into the same people and building relationships. We also built relationships with a lot of local people. We went out of our way to meet local people everywhere we went. And we also stayed in touch with our dear friends via social media. I don't know what I would do without Instagram and Facebook. We really, since we didn't go home for a whole year, it was really important that people kept in touch with us and we kept in touch with people. And we felt like we had our little 33-foot boat was filled with a couple of hundred good friends.
And James, you both mentioned the locks. I like locks. I like just watching, you know, standing on the shore and watching boats go through them. 106, though, did you ever get tired of locks or were they still cool after, you know, number 105?
Well, they're physically kind of demanding, and sometimes you have to wait because pleasure boats are the lowest priority in locks. Commercial traffic has purse dibs on a transit through the locks. And so, you know, sometimes, especially on the rivers, on the Mississippi River, I had to wait several hours at a lock in order to get through. And, you know, the surface of Lake Michigan is about 579 feet above sea level. So in order to get from here to the Atlantic Ocean, you have to go down 579 feet, which means a lot of locks. And then to get back, you have to go up 579 feet. So you're transiting all sorts of locks. But I'll tell you what, the people that operate the locks are public servants in the best sense. They were all very nice and very professional, and we always had wonderful experiences with them.
And so I got to ask, as we wrap up, you were gone for well over a year. You said you were in social media contact with people. What was homecoming like, though, getting back home and seeing everybody and starting to settle back in?
Well, I would say, like in The Wizard of Oz, like Dorothy said, there's no place like home. It was just wonderful to get back home and see all our friends and family and to reintegrate ourselves into our community once again.
And Jill, your thoughts on homecoming?
Well, you know, we didn't get to see our grown sons for a whole year and their ladies. And they came down and caught the lines for us. We also had James and I put some bucks on the bar at the Stage Door Pub, the Irish pub in our town, and everyone came out and had a beer with us. And, you know, it was very, very touching. I have to say, in a lot of ways, you know, we came back different people from this trip, and I'd say even better people. You know, just really appreciating all the people in our lives and appreciating our country. It looks a lot better from the water when you don't see strip malls and you don't have to ride on a bunch of ugly highways. You know, it's a pretty wonderful country. And Canada, we love so much. Our Canadian friends are so important to us. So, you know, it's great to be home. Not to say we won't have another adventure, because we've got some planned.
Thank you both so much for joining us, and congratulations on completing the trip. We've been talking to Jill and James Iverson. They live in Manitowoc. They recently completed a year-plus journey around the eastern part of the U.S. on their boat. It's called The Great Loop. They're in the process of writing a book about the experience. And you can find more info on their Instagram page. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a local author's obsession with his favorite snack.
All right, I like to snack just as much as the next person. My go-to, chips and salsa. And I have a serious weak spot for meat snacks, jerky, summer sausage. But I met this guy, Jesse, who's taken things to the next level.
My name is Jesse Brookstein, all-around meat geek and author of A Perfect Pair, The History of Landeger in Greene County, Wisconsin.
Did you catch that? He wrote a book about one particular type of snack sausage. I thought it was pronounced Landjager.
But the proper pronunciation is Landjager.
Landjager. Got it. Jesse and I met up at Bavaria Sausage in Madison, Wisconsin, so I could learn a little more. He introduced me to the owner.
My name is Judy Cottrell. I'm the owner of Bavaria Sausage.
Judy's a lifer at Bavaria.
I've been here my whole life because my parents started this business. So I've been peeling wieners since I was 5.
Bavaria's been making sausage in Madison since the early 60s.
So my dad is a master sausage maker, master spice mixer from Bavaria. So these are all authentic Bavarian recipes.
Including the recipe for Landjager, which I asked her to share with our radio audience.
Share the recipe,
yeah,
the ingredients?
You just go ahead and I'll record it.
Yeah. All I'll say is they're all beef, no fillers, no additives, no MSG. Natural hickory smoke.
So that's all we get?
That's all you get.
So what sets Landjager apart?
Landjager is a shelf-stable product. So it goes through a fermentation process in here that drops the pH to such a level that there's no longer any spoilage or pathogenic bacteria in this product.
All right, no refrigeration necessary. They're also kind of flattened, like a long rectangle.
That's done with these molds or these presses that the Landjager producers have. And not only are they in that rectangular shape, but they also come as a pair. And that's part of the reason I think Landjäger stands out as opposed to so many other sausages in the world, is that unique form and shape.
So let's investigate. First, where'd it come from? I'm guessing Germany?
But it seems like it somewhat spread from what we now know as westernmost point of Austria into Germany, into Switzerland, and into a Swiss-German-French region of France called Alsace.
Okay, and so what about the name?
The direct translation is Landjäger is land hunter or country hunter.
Jesse found they were popular among hunters and game wardens hiking around the forests of the region. And later, folks from that region emigrated to the United States and settled in spots like southern Wisconsin and upstate New York, where Jesse grew up. When he moved to Wisconsin, he spotted Landjäger all over the place, hanging in their classic chalet-style display cases.
And the geek that I am, I took that childhood relationship I had with it to this adulthood infatuation, I guess you could say it's become, and started researching it, and the book was born.
You found a bunch of makers in Greene County, where Swiss immigrants settled in places like New Glarus. And it also led him to Judy at Bavaria Sausage.
I mean, I think we've been making them over 60 years. These have won gold medal in international competition. So, you know they're good, we know they sell, we make a lot of them.
Judy says it's a labor of love and a dying art.
You know, there's probably a handful of places left like us in the whole United States that really have the family recipes.
But Judy says that tradition extends to her generations of loyal customers, too.
You know, it's something that gets passed on to generation to generation.
So, speaking of passing things on...
One more chance. You want to share the recipe?
That would kill my livelihood right there.
Had to try.
So that's pretty much what we do.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. And thanks, Jesse.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate it.
For more on Landjäger and Jesse's book, you can visit his website, KarateFightPublishing.com. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll learn about NASA's Artemis 1 launch. It launched last week. It's the first step to getting humans back on the moon after a 50-year hiatus. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. NASA's Space Launch System rocket went into space last week, starting the Artemis 1 mission. Artemis 1 is the first step in a three-part mission to get humans back on the moon after a 50-year absence. Jack Burns is a professor in the Department of Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences and professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Colorado Boulder. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
So as I mentioned, Artemis 1 launched last week. What have we seen so far?
Well, it's going very well. In fact, it's nearly flawless, is what I understand from NASA at this point. It was, we had a number of delays going all the way back to August and September, but when it finally launched, it's been functioning extremely well, and now it's in the orbit of the moon.
This is part of a bigger mission, the last stage of which is to get humans back on to the moon. Can you talk about that long-term goal of not just probes, uncrewed probes, but bringing humans back onto the moon's surface?
Yes, this first mission is just to test out the system. Then Artemis 2, which is going to launch in about 2 years, will have the first crew. They too will orbit the moon. And then finally, Artemis 3 in 2025-2026 will land. That will be the first humans on the moon in the 21st century. And as NASA likes to advertise, it'll be the first woman and the first person of color to be able to go to the moon. So Artemis is very different than Apollo in that it is intended not to be a short-term program, not to fulfill political goals, but to be a long-term sustainable set of missions that will result in a long-term presence on the surface for science, for extraction of resources, to manufacture materials using lunar metals and oxygen, and even water from the surface of the moon.
It's a long road to get to that point. With Artemis 1, what are some of the key things that we need to find out to make sure that Artemis 2, with actual humans on board, are ready to go up?
Yes, mainly to test out the engineering systems. So obviously the first step was the launch, make sure that this new rocket, the Space Launch System, was working. That's a box we can tick off now. Next is to understand the radiation environment in the moon. The Orion spacecraft, which will house the astronauts as part of the launch system, is in orbit of the moon, and it's going to be there for about 25 days. And we'll test out all of the communications, the computer systems, and see how everything does in terms of the radiation environment. Because once we're away from the Earth's magnetic field, we no longer have that protection. So that's one thing that they're looking at doing, to test out all those systems. Then very importantly is coming back from the moon. The Orion spacecraft is going to be traveling at over 25,000 miles per hour. And so when it hits the atmosphere, the big item to be tested is the heat shield, because that heat shield is absolutely essential to protect the astronauts. Now, we have high confidence that's going to work, because we certainly have well over 50 years of experience with such heat shields, and this is a modern version of what was used by Apollo.
Now, the Apollo missions successfully delivered people to the moon a couple of few times. We got to do a little science, humankind. The astronauts got to do a little science on the lunar surface, but their time was limited, their gear was limited. What kind of hopes do you have for science we can do on the lunar surface if we can return there?
Well, this time Artemis really is largely about science, and it's not driven as was Apollo with the political goals. So the science is very broad based. One of the things we are excited to do is to go to the lunar far side and to something called the South Pole Aiken Basin, which is the oldest, largest impact basin in the inner solar system, bring some samples back, because that's going to tell us information about the formation of not just the moon, but the Earth-Moon system and the time period in which life was first formed. So learning about ourselves and our history is one of the important goals of Artemis. Another goal, something that I'm working on as an astronomer, is we're going to be setting up radio telescopes on the surface of the moon. Our first mission actually is going to be in March. We have a unmanned lunar lander we'll be setting down in the South Pole, and that will be followed in subsequent years by putting down an array of radio telescopes on the radio quiet far side, which is always facing away from the Earth.
Okay, I was going to ask my next question, is what are the benefits of parking a radio telescope on the moon in particular? I guess we have a lot of radio waves here on the Earth, or otherwise I wouldn't have a job, for starters.
Well, that's exactly right. All of the, there's a great deal of radio interference. That's number one. But also number two is our own ionosphere. Our ionosphere bounces the lower frequency radio waves back into space, so they don't even penetrate all the way to the surface. This is frequencies below about 10 or 15 or 20 megahertz, so below the FM band. But that is a key part of the spectrum for us to open up on the moon, because that allows us to probe an unexplored part of the universe called the Dark Ages. This is before the first stars and galaxies formed.
Wow. When could we start, assuming all goes well with landing this and installing it and firing it up, when can we start to see results from that radio telescope on the far side of the moon?
Well, our first mission to the far side is already scheduled and fully funded. It's a mission called Lucy that will be a single radio telescope, a pair of antennas, and will be operating through the night. And this will be our first attempt to do what we call cosmology, from the moon. That is to explore that early epoch. That's going to happen in 2025.
Now, you mentioned part of the goal of having crews land on the moon is to have some kind of sustainable presence there and being able to manufacture some of the things humans would need on the moon using local materials. In our last minute or so, are there enough of those materials to use on the moon?
Oh, yes. The moon has all the same elements as does the Earth. And we've learned in the last decade, it also has water ice at the poles. That water ice is in principle like gold, or maybe even a better analog, petroleum is on the Earth, because we can take the water, split it into hydrogen and oxygen, recombine it into rocket fuel, which we don't have to then bring all of that rocket fuel from the Earth. It's a lot easier to lift it off the moon. So the moon could become a fuel depot for launches, not only from the moon, but launches that then go further out into space, including trips to Mars.
Jack, thanks again for joining us today.
You're certainly welcome.
That's Jack Burns, professor in the Department of Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. He talked to us about NASA's Artemis 1 mission. It launched last week, the first, as we heard, in what's expected to be a long line of moon-related missions. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll delve into the history behind a Wisconsin legend, the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, and the rise and fall of the company behind it, all centered around their roots in Lake Geneva. And when you try learning a new skill or hobby, chances are you're not going to be that good at it, and that's okay. We'll find out what we can learn from being bad at things and why those things are still worth doing. If you've got one of those you're trying right now, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And we talked to former Wisconsin Republican Congressman Reed Ribble about his thoughts on the 2022 midterms and what he wants the Republican Party to prioritize in the year to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the midterm elections ran smoothly this year for the most part. A political scientist says that's good news, but we need to invest more in state and local election administration to make voting a better process in the future. First, Republicans fared worse than expected in this year's midterms, with predictions of a red wave that didn't pan out. There are lots of different explanations for why that is. Many political watchers, including some Republicans, point to the poor performance of candidates who denied the results of the 2020 election and were backed by former President Donald Trump. Our next guest says the GOP needs to reject conspiracies and falsehoods and wants to see the party he was part of for 6 years in Congress make a commitment to principles and the Constitution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What messages, if any, do you see in this year's midterm election results? Did you feel in some ways like democracy was on the ballot? If you are a Republican yourself or generally lean Republican, what do you want to see next from the party with its control of the House in future elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Ribble is a former Republican U.S. representative from Sherwood who represented Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. That includes Green Bay. He retired from that office in 2017. Representative Ribble, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's good to be with you.
A lot of people out there with thoughts on why the red wave didn't quite pan out around the country. What was on your mind in the days following the election?
Well, I think the election actually panned out about the way that I saw it. I had tweeted a couple of weeks before the election, and I didn't see a red wave actually forming, in part because I think that a lot of the Trump candidates, endorsed candidates in the primary, were great for the Republican base, but horrible for general elections. And I think that ended up being the case. And we particularly saw that in the state of Pennsylvania, where you had a Republican governor candidate who just tanked both in the polls and in the election. And the Democrat governor candidate pulled the Democrat Senate candidate through the process.
What does that mean for the future of the Republican Party? What do you want to see the party do in response to those outcomes?
Well, I think they have to be honest with themselves and have to do an audit to figure out why they're losing suburban voters, in particular suburban women, and also younger voters. Gen Z, for example, went heavily toward the Democrats. And Republicans have to ask themselves, are we actually campaigning on ideas that matter, or do we need to change direction? And I think the answer is populism is not popular, and they need to change directions. I mean, that's only going to happen if they're honest with themselves.
If I'm a Republican running for office with the possibility of a primary, that might be a tough message for me. I might do better in a general election if I do what you're saying. I might not win a primary if I do what you're saying and offend a significant part of the party base. What would you tell a candidate who came to you for advice if they were having those feelings?
I think that you can be honest without being hateful. And so the idea that you reject everything that Republicans have done, or you get on radio or in your advertising and public speeches demonizing President Trump, I don't think that that's necessarily the right approach. I think we can look at what Governor Youngkin did in Virginia as a model, where he just kind of ignored Trump. He never made it part of the discussion in his campaigns. He didn't invite the president to come and campaign with him. And as a result of that, he won the election based on ideas and policy rather than personality. And I think that was smart. And that's how I would advise any candidate running tomorrow.
On issues, what do you want to see from the Republican Party?
You know, I think they have to actually govern in the way that they campaigned. And what I mean by that is they have to stop talking about investigations and Hunter Biden, for God's sake. They just have to get rid of all that nonsense, and they have to deal with what people said that matters to them. They don't like paying, $3 to $4 a gallon for gasoline. They don't like the fact that their grocery bill has gone up 25%. I think this issue of inflation really matters to people, because everything costs more and it's stretching voters thin. And I think they should focus on issues of economics. And I also think that the issue of crime is important, and they need to try to figure out what they can do from a policy standpoint to begin to reduce crime in our major metropolitan areas. And if they would do that, they would be able to pull some of those suburban women back into the fold.
We've seen tweets from Republican House leadership and press conferences and announcements saying Hunter Biden investigations are on the way. What are you watching for there? What are your reactions when you see that?
I think that's all going to tank in the public. The fact of the matter is most Americans are not interested in what the president's children do. And the problem I have with this whole thing, Rob, is that if Republicans all lean into this Hunter Biden thing, what's going to happen as soon as Democrats take over? They're going to go after Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and Don Jr. and Eric Jr. And you're never going to end. And the fact of the matter is, we ought to judge presidents based on what presidents do and the policies that they bring to the forefront, and whether they're taking care of roads and bridges and the things that really matter to the voter. And I will tell you that Hunter Biden doesn't resonate with a lot of Republican voters. That's why they didn't campaign on it. They campaigned on crime and inflation. But the minute they won, the first thing they talked about was Hunter Biden. It's ridiculous, and it's going to be damaging to them.
Talking to Reid Ribble, former Republican congressman from Wisconsin, looking at the future of the Republican Party. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I wonder if you share my excitement. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in 2024. We now have more elected Republicans in Congress than we've had in a long time. And in a generation, up here in northern Wisconsin, we got 3 elected Republican representatives in the Assembly and the Senate. The Republican Party was started in Ripon, Wisconsin, 1854. Aren't we in a position to renew and refresh our political agenda here?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And if leadership in the state of Wisconsin, in both the Senate and the Assembly, would focus on the things that matter to Wisconsin voters, they would be in a good position. And I was encouraged by the fact that Robin Voss met with Governor Evers recently. I think that that's a step forward. The fact of the matter is Wisconsin has done what Wisconsin does. They're a bit schizophrenic in how they vote, right? They put a Democrat governor in charge, but then they continue to put Republicans in charge of the legislative body. And so the citizens are saying, we want you to work together for the good of the citizens of Wisconsin. And I hope they do that by watching what they're doing with taxation, fixing the roads and bridges in the state, getting broadband available in rural Wisconsin. Those would be things that would really help them along the way and also help Wisconsin citizens.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned that brief, I think, Voss-Evers meeting. Republicans and Democrats in Wisconsin state government not playing well together much lately. Same goes for Congress. Do you see areas where you think cooperation is possible and maybe even likely?
I think at the state level, sure. And the state level's always had a bit more comity in it than the federal level has. And so I think there are some opportunities. I just mentioned a couple with infrastructure and broadband, also crime. There's not a lot that Governor Evers can do about, or the assembly can do about inflation. At the federal level, certainly if they would expand leases and the production of energy in the U.S., I think that that would help pull some gasoline prices down and home heating and natural gas prices down. All those things would help. But at the federal level, I just don't see it. I think that it's going to be chaos for another 2 years with hardly anything getting done. With one exception, Rob, I think it's possible that they could get something done on immigration reform, because the crisis at the border is real. And the fact that employers cannot find enough workers is real. And there's an opportunity for bipartisan reform to happen there.
We're talking to Reed Ribble, former Republican member of Congress who represented Wisconsin's 8th District until 2017. With us today to reflect on this year's midterm election results, what they mean for the future of the Republican Party here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a midterm election lesson that you think Republicans should follow, whether you are a Republican or not? What questions do you have for former Representative Ribble about the current state of the party and American and Wisconsin politics? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the future of the Republican Party. After Republicans did not as well as expected in this year's midterm elections, former Republican U.S. Representative Reed Ribble stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. If you are a Republican in particular, what are you hoping to see or hear from your party? 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls. Rebecca is with us in Mineral Point. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Rebecca?
Well, for Mr. Ribble, I am finding it a very good conversation. I'm an independent voter, and I'm enjoying listening to his comments. But my question is, he mentioned that Wisconsin elected a Democratic governor, and yet our state legislature is overly Republican, and that he says that that means we want them to work together. But my question is, when our state is gerrymandered, that it's near impossible in some areas to elect a Democrat, how can that be? How is he reading that? I'm confused. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Rebecca, thanks for calling. Gerrymandered, I think, is the word that was cut off by your phone line.
Yeah,
right. There.
Yeah. No, thanks, Rebecca. I mean, you're right in one regard, that the districts are gerrymandered, but in reality, if you look at the overall county map of the state of Wisconsin, almost all the rural areas are Republican and red, and the more urban, suburban, exurban areas are Democratic. It's very difficult to draw maps in a state like Wisconsin, where the population is so densely compacted in Milwaukee and Madison, Green Bay, cities like that, and draw a district that will pull those blue voters, because they're compacted, they're too densely populated, and people have a tendency to move to where they have affinity with other people. So Republicans have a tendency to move to rural areas, and Democrats have a tendency to move to urban areas. And it would be almost impossible to draw a map in the state of Wisconsin that would not have the same divide. You could maybe pull some blue areas down and some red areas down and make them more blue, but you wouldn't be able to draw a map that I think would change much of the nature of the state assembly for sure, maybe more impact on the state Senate. But just by virtue of where people live in Wisconsin, it'd be very difficult to draw a map that didn't result in a Republican assembly.
Thanks for that call. When I've talked to the numbers people on that, they agree there is a natural gerrymander, as you're talking about, Representative Ribble. But the way the lines were drawn magnify that some and make it almost as easy for Republicans to get a supermajority in the assembly as Democrats to get a narrow majority in the assembly. There's a little of both going on, right?
I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, political parties are going to do that. And if you lived in Illinois, like I did for a few years, you would see the inverse of that, where the Democrats are basically drawing districts to eliminate Republican seats entirely. Adam Kinzinger, for example, his seat was eliminated, and he was one of the more pragmatic members of the Illinois delegation. And so you would think they would have gerrymandered out one of the more hard right guys in Southern Illinois, but they couldn't do it because of the way the voters that live and kind of separate themselves. But I don't disagree with you, Rob. It's been gerrymandered, and I would prefer that voters pick their candidates or their elected officials rather than the inverse.
Thanks again for that call. Bill joins us now in Waupaca. Bill, hi.
Hello, Representative Ribble. I was one of your constituents when you were in Congress, and I think you earned the respect of both Democrats and Republicans when you were in Congress. So my question is, I think it could win if you entered the governor's race. What are your thoughts on that?
Bill, I appreciate that. That's a really kind thing to say. But when I left Congress, I told people that my primary purpose in leaving was to spend more time with my grandchildren, who I've got a 1-year-old all the way to a 19-year-old that's studying at the University of Alabama. And I wanted to be closer to them, and they live in Tennessee, and I spend the bulk of my time down in Tennessee so I can be closer to them. And so I think my time has come and gone for being an elected official, but I can have some opportunity to weigh in on things and try to balance things out by having conversations like I'm having with Rob and with you today.
Bill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Bill used a phrase there, Representative Ribble, you know, respected by Democrats and Republicans, and he said it like it was a good thing. I think there's a lot of people at either party who would take that as an insult. If you're respected by the other party, you must be doing something wrong.
Well, exactly. And I heard that all the time. I would often say I've got 10% of my voters screaming at me in the right ear and 10% of my voters screaming at me in my left ear. And the 80%, those people who actually really liked what I was doing, they just went about their business. They went to work. They watched their kids play soccer and go to concerts, and they lived their lives. And they told me, you know, Congressman, I just want you to deal with those issues, and you make the best judgment you can. And by being more pragmatic, I think the voters in the broad swipe, both across party lines, appreciated the work that I did.
Talking to former congressional representative from Wisconsin, Reed Ribble, about the future of the Republican Party and American politics, Wisconsin politics more generally. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Door County. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. Great topic. I appreciate what he's saying about crossing the aisle and getting back to business to do what the people want. But I am a little concerned about some of the rhetoric, like the price of gas. I just paid $3 for a gallon of gas. So, and gas isn't controlled by the president that's sitting. And the thing about crime is up in the inner city. It's not up in the suburbs. And these talking points are being driven by our representatives.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I think we lost Jeff at the end of that sentence. Yeah. There, Representative Ribble, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I appreciate what he's saying. And the idea that gas isn't controlled by the president is partially accurate. But it's only partially so. All gasoline is priced based on global supply of oil. And so obviously if the Saudis if Russia reduces the supply, it's going to shove the price up. But that doesn't mean that the country with the most oil, which is us, couldn't increase productivity and expand our production, expand refineries. But it takes years and years and years just to get a permit to build a refinery in the United States today. And so there are policy things that we could do. And I don't think he's wrong regarding crime. in that if you lived in rural Wisconsin, you're probably not too concerned about it. But if we were having a caller call us from the inner city of Milwaukee, they would be very concerned about it. And so it just depends on where you live and the ideas that impact you. And so I partially agree with Jeff, but I partially disagree.
Thanks again for that call. Something that I think about a lot is in Congress in particular, I think it seems like the incentive structure is to not cooperate with the other party, to not look for that compromise, the common ground, appeal to the base, not move toward moderation. Do you see that? Do you see that as a problem? If so, what could be done about it?
Yeah, it's absolutely a problem. However, I do think that depending on how you talk to people, how you conduct yourself, what most people want is they want government to work. I did hear from Republican constituents that I was playing too nicely with the Democrats. But at the end of the day, when you really had a chance to sit down and talk with them and kind of dig a little bit deeper, what they wanted was they did want government to actually work. They just didn't appreciate the policy reforms or the compromises that might have to happen to get to a bipartisan agreement. And I heard often, don't compromise your principles. And my response to that is, I'll guarantee you that I will never compromise a principle, but you must allow me to seek a principled compromise. And when you would talk with people in the right manner and you wouldn't demonize someone for how they felt about something, you were able to find you were able to find common ground with even the hard right or hard left.
Our next conversation on the show today is going to be about how the midterm elections were managed and possible changes in the future. You've written about claims of election wrongdoing over the last couple of elections. Can you share some of your thoughts as you've watched, especially the Republican Party on these issues?
Yeah, we don't really have an election integrity problem in the country. Never have had. There's always been instances of fraud, and there's been some fraud that's taken place. I think you can always find it, but it's really, really in the fringes, and it's a very small number. And so, first of all, we have to stop telling people that we've got all this election integrity problem because we don't. And that's just the harsh reality of it. And what we have to realize is that in all those thousands of precincts across the state of Wisconsin, they're typically manned and votes are typically counted by volunteers, mostly senior citizens, Democrats and Republicans alike, who just want to do a public service. Our elections are governed by our neighbors. And I would just encourage people to trust your neighbor. If you don't trust government officials, at least trust them. And we can build some confidence back in our elections, because our elections are fair and they're being managed in a positive way. That doesn't mean we can't do better, but they're not horrible.
We've seen in Wisconsin, we had a Republican candidate for governor who ran kind of against the election system, finished a very distant third place. Former President Trump tried to support a primary challenge to Robin Voss because Voss wouldn't support Trump's election claims. Voss will still be the speaker. Are you encouraged by some of the signs you've seen here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, because I think Wisconsinites are pretty pragmatic folks. When you kind of get underneath all the layers of partisanship, they're a pragmatic group. And so I am encouraged by that.
Representative Ribble, thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
That's Reid Ribble, former Republican U.S. representative who represented Wisconsin's 8th House District. He was with us today to reflect on this year's midterm elections, what the results could mean for the future direction of the Republican Party. Coming up after the news, we'll turn from the politics to the process of the midterm elections, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago. Our next guest says things went smoothly, but there's a lot we can do to improve voting in the United States, especially when it comes to supporting local election offices and polling stations. If you worked on the election this midterm year, or if you've done it many years, you did it in the past, love to hear your story. You can get us started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or hang on and call in after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime at WPR.org or with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Listen live to either of our networks, and you can pull up archived content as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time.